or more of me. And this is What's a Crack. See you guys later.
KPP Concerts presents a stacked lineup of shows this winter in partnership with CFRC 101.9 FM, featuring a mix of big-name acts and some local faves as well. On March 8th, Montreal punks The Anti-Queens hit the stage in celebration of International Women's Day. Then, on March 14th, don't miss Kingston's Good Times supergroup, Rocket Surgery. On March 16th, the Great Big C's Sean McCann hits the Spire, and the Mahones rage the stage on St. Patrick's Day. On March 20th, the Cancer Bats return to town, and on March 22nd, Canadian pop sensation and Queens alum Devin Cole puts on a show. And on March 29th, don't miss the sweet sounds of Dom Lewis. Unless noted, all KPP shows co-presented by CFRC 101.9 FM take place at the Broom Factory. For full info and tickets, visit kppconcerts.com.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's news collective Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Isabella Garrido, Jaya Kumar, and Abyaz Karim. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. After announcing the festival would be folding in the first week of 2025, Kingston Writers Fest is now hoping to return for a 17th season in fall 2025. The festival sent out a message in January citing ongoing financial challenges as the downfall of the event, running in a deficit even with a scaled-down festival in 2024. However, with the launch of a fundraising campaign on February 1st, the festival may have a second chance. The festival's co-founder, Marilyn Simons, who served as artistic director from 2009 to 2014, stepped back into the spotlight this January to address the financial difficulties, launching an angel campaign. Simons described the events in an interview with CFRC.
I was artistic director from 2009 to 2014. My goal was to start the festival and to make it financially stable. But my real life is as a writer, so I left it at that point and stayed engaged as an audience member and certainly presented all my books there. In January, I became engaged with the festival again in an attempt to solve some of its financial problems that arose last year.
I was wondering if you could speak a bit about this angel campaign and how that came to be after the announcement that Writers Fest was folding.
You know, like everyone, I received the same sort of public announcement that everyone did, and you know, I sat around mourning for a little bit because this was our baby. And then I thought, well, heck, maybe there's something we can do. And so I called up Jan Walter, who was my co-founder with the festival, and the current chair, and Justin Conitis, who's a longtime supporter of the festival. And together we decided that we would mount an angel campaign, that we figured out how much was owing and how much we needed to raise. And at the same time, CRA decided that because of the postal strike, they were extending the deadline for 2024 charitable receipts till the end of February. So we started a one-month campaign, and basically we just called up all the supporters of the festival that we could think of, and the response was just, oh, it was so gratifying. One of the writers that we had, we were the first festival to showcase her, and you know, she wrote and said she would never forget that, and she gave us money. Lots of people all across Canada donated funds and became angels. So it was within a couple of weeks we had enough money to start paying back to start meeting the debts of Kingston Writers Fest. And now almost all of those debts are covered. We have some more money coming in March. And when that comes in, we will have retired all of the debts.
While covering 2024 debts was the original goal of the campaign, Simon says Writers Fest is now focused on rebuilding.
The enthusiasm was huge. And that itself was extremely, not only satisfying, but invigorating for those of us who were working on this. We realized that, like us, people in the community really, really valued this festival, as did writers and publishers across the country. So that gave us the motivation to do the work, the second stage of the work, which is the first stage was making, you know, sort of clearing the debt. The second stage is to rebuilding. And the third stage will be to plan the next step. And we're considering many things. Most importantly, a summer reading series and a somewhat reconfigured festival in the fall.
That soon, in September 2025, you think Writers Fest could be coming back?
Yeah, because, I mean, what a lot of people don't realize is that when we started this festival in 2009, we had our first meeting on March 27th. And on September 25th, we opened the doors to a festival with over 30 events, and we had an audience of more than 3,000. So we know this can be done.
There's more fundraising ahead, but what else do we need to get Writers Fest back on its feet? What's next?
I think planning. Mm-hmm. We put together a really good board that has the a tremendous amount of skill in financial management, legal, governance, strategic planning, risk management. And so it will be the board's job to lay the groundwork for the next festival so that it can be sustainable and continue on. This community really loves this festival. There have been people who have been coming every year for 16 years. And there are new readers who are just discovering it. So the work now will be mostly behind the scenes. We'll be having other fund development campaigns. We'll be probably mounting a couple of fundraisers. We'll be applying for grants. We'll be doing all the, you know, all the usual things that festivals have to do in order to in order to give this gift of books to the community.
Simons also discussed the challenging landscape that put Writers Fest in jeopardy and what returning to the playing field could look like.
It's kind of a perfect storm of circumstances. COVID hit a lot of festivals of this size very hard because people couldn't come out. So festivals had a variety of responses to that. Most of them had online events, but of course people don't pay for those, right? Mm-hmm. So you still have to keep your staff on, but you're not getting any money in. At the same time, a lot of the granting bodies reduced their grants. And people, I think a lot of festivals, their response to coming back to in-person events was to make their festivals smaller, not be too ambitious. And unfortunately, with something like this, you need a certain size in order for the festival to be sustainable. So there were a lot of things that kind of conspired all at once to do this. And Kingston Writers Fest isn't alone. I just heard that the Toronto Festival of Authors is moving off out of Harbourfront and reconfiguring itself, you know, for many of the same reasons. And I know of other smaller festivals that are in the process of doing the same thing. I personally, I work with a festival in San Miguel in Mexico. I live here half the year. And I work with a tricultural festival here, which really struggled the last 3 years. And this year, people came back in droves. So all the events were sold out, and I'm talking 1,000-seat venues. And what was really interesting to me is that the demographic changed, is that there were far fewer, what I like to call Q-tips, whiteheads in the audience. The demographic, the age range was more people in midlife and younger. And so I think I feel encourages me a great deal for Kingston Writers Fest this fall. Is I expect that the audiences will come out. It takes good programming too, and we're working on that. We have some fabulous ideas for programming. So I'm hoping that people will come out and we'll be able to develop a new audience of readers and writers.
The Angel Campaign will continue as Writers Fest prepares for its comeback in September 2025. And Simons remains hopeful that Kingston's reading and writing community will be able to keep the festival afloat.
I discovered very early on when I was working on Kingston Writers Fest and developing it, is that we weren't developing a festival so much as we were developing a community. And I think that's the hugely satisfying part of Kingston Writers Fest, is that readers and writers come together to talk about ideas and books, and it's a book love fest, really. And you know, as a writer, there's no place I'd rather be.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Hello folks, I'm Abiyaz from CFRC News, and you're listening to our segment Campus Corner. Here we bring you the latest updates from Queen's Campus. Today we are in conversation with Mr. Nicholas. He is the Business Director of Queen's Aerospace Design Team. On this segment, we are broadcasting the shorter version of our conversation with Nicholas. If you want to listen to the entire version, check out podcasts on our website. Hello, Nicholas. Can you tell our audience a bit more about yourself, your background, your journey to aerospace and QADT?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Nico. I'm a fifth year computing student at Queen's University, and I'm currently the director of business in the Queen's Aerospace Design Team. For me, it was mostly my internship. I did an internship with Smith Engineering.
Right.
And working with Smith Engineering had me working a lot with students, and more specifically design teams that are started by students.
Hmm.
I worked formerly with the Queen's Hyperloop Design Team, the Queen's Robotic Knights Team, the Queen's Space Engineering Team, Rocket Engineering Team, and more specifically, obviously, the Aerospace Design Team as well. And I always had a curiosity with aerospace. I've always been amazed about planes. I've always been very, very curious about how planes work as a kid. And as a young adult, going on a plane still amazes me how we've been able to engineer such a wonderful, large machine that's been able to transport us all around the world in much, much faster time than boats previously in the past. So I got interested in aerospace because of just my genuine interest in planes and my love for travel. It made logical sense, so I applied. And it's been a welcoming experience. They've been very, the Queen's Aerospace Design Team has always been very welcoming to me, and we've definitely done a lot. We've done a lot this year, and very happy to be a part of the team.
If we dive into the operations of QADT, so I hear that you guys are all set to compete in Alberta, Florida, and Mexico next year. Can you share some more details about these competitions and what makes them exciting?
Sure. These competitions are competitions that we enroll ourselves in. We compete with other universities across North America, Canada, U.S., Mexico, of course, and also in some instances international. So European teams or teams coming from Asia, like, for example, Turkey or even Southeast Asia and India, China, etc. So it's a wonderful opportunity, one, to network with other teams around the world and share and exchange ideas, which is great. Second of all, it's an excellent opportunity to work with other domestic Canadian design teams.
Wow.
So that we can also do the exact same, compete with one another, exchange with one another. More specifically, a lot of the competitions right now is actually manufacturing and assembling drones for forest firefighting.
Right.
So our drone, Night Fury Rift 1, is designed to fight forest fires. More specifically, is that it has become a bigger issue in Canada and also in the United States.
Right.
So we've been competing. Last year, actually, we ranked 6th overall and first in undergraduate design teams in our competition in London. And the other teams, for context, had master's students, PhD students. And we're all just undergraduate students in our instances, in our case,
right?
Who have very little experience compared to everyone else. So we're very proud of that result, and we're looking forward to this year's competitions. And I'm more than confident that we'll be doing just as good, if not better.
Wow. Tell us a bit about QADT's preparation phase for the competitions. Like, is there any key aspect or feature that the judges look for in these competitions?
Well, one big thing is obviously our drones. So we have to make sure our drone's up to standard, that we're doing everything in terms of safety protocols, that we're doing everything in our ability to ensure that our drone is performing at its best capacity.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. We obviously have the technical side of things to ensure that our technical, our software, our electricity, our drone itself is ready for the competition. Secondly, of course, you have to make sure that our team is ready. Obviously, we're a team that relies heavy on teamwork and collaboration with one another. So we select a handful of representatives from our technical side of things, and also from all different types of technical, so from electric to software to mechanical, to ensure that all our spots on our drone are covered should something need to be done or fixed at the competition. And we also have individuals who are just interested to participate. For example, during domestic competitions, we've always we always encourage our members, even general members, to come participate and get involved. So we were very successful in doing that last year when we had our competition in Quebec. And then third, of course, is the finances. And none of this is free, of course. So we, especially in the sponsorship team and obviously our logistics team, ensures that we have the financial capacity to be able to bring our drone from one place to another, or of course, bring our team members if we can, and we work obviously very hard to ensure that our financing is responsible, and that we are doing everything to our ability to make sure everyone has a good time while they're representing us from afar.
Let's say if any of our audience are interested in joining QADT, how can they do it?
Follow us on Instagram. It's Queens with the S, so QUEENS. Aero, AERO. Follow us for Instagram and just keep being updated with our Instagram and our hiring updates. And come visit us at any point, Beamish. We're at the design bay at the very end.
Great. Thank you, Nico. Thanks for joining us. It was lovely talking to you. Thank you very much.
Perfect. Thank you for having me.
And that's a wrap, folks. We were conversing about the aerospace industry with Mr. Nico. He is an aerospace enthusiast who also happens to be the business director of Queen's Aerospace Design Team. As I said, this was the shorter version of the conversation we had with Nicholas. In order to check out the fuller version, visit our website and check the podcast. And that's a wrap. I'm Abias from CFRC News, and you are listening to our segment Campus Corner.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Beginning with Monday, March 17th, a cooler day after a run of some unseasonably warm temperatures, daytime high of 4 degrees and it was sunny, going to drop down to a chilly minus 6 overnight. Tuesday, March 18th, a little bit warmer, 6 degrees and sunny, dropping down to a neutral 0 overnight. Wednesday, March 19th, It's going to be back into the double-digit temperatures, 12 degrees and sunny, dropping down to 4 overnight with a 30% chance of precipitation. Thursday, March 20th, we're going to see a daytime high of 7 degrees, and there is a 60% chance of showers throughout the day. Friday, March 21st, it's going to be 3 degrees with a mix of sun and cloud. Saturday, March 22nd, a little bit warmer at 9 degrees. It will be cloudy, dropping down to as low as minus 2 overnight. Sunday, March 23rd, daytime high of 5 degrees and it will be cloudy. And Monday, March 24th, high of 7, but a 40% chance of precipitation. This is Jesse Bell with your City of Kingston Traffic Report. Reminder that reduced load restrictions are in effect in Kingston as of March 1st. Heavy trucks and loads are restricted on city roads where posted. These restrictions help reduce damage to roads in the spring. A complete list of roads with restrictions can be found in the Traffic Bylaw section of the City of Kingston website. Road closures. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess to 486 Albert is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Work is still ongoing at the Hanson Memorial Parking Structure. This work will take place throughout all levels of the building and will include efforts such as routine structural maintenance, repainting, replacement of waterproofing materials, and upgrades to the building's mechanical and electrical systems. The work is planned to conclude in July 2025. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club. Expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Montreal Street at John Counter. Expect delays for upgrades to the intersection, including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users and to accommodate increased traffic coming from the Wabin Crossing.
Hello, I'm Henry Walker, CFRC intern from the Queen's Department of History. Here's today's concert and events calendar. Starting with concerts, coming up on Monday, the Mahones will be playing a St. Patrick's Day concert at the Broom Factory with doors opening at 7 p.m. Tickets are available online on Ticket Scene. The club at the RCHA will be hosting the Dave Barton Trio from 4:30 to 6:30. There will be a $5 door charge. Also on Monday, the Morning Doves will be playing at Musiki from 8 to 11 p.m. Tiernanog, as part of their St. Patrick's Day celebrations, will be having a number of performers on Monday afternoon, including Frank Ryan from 1 to 4 p.m., Band the Fiddleheads from 5 to 8 p.m., and Kevin in the Kitchen Sink from 9 to midnight. Another spot folks can head down to for their St. Patrick's Day celebrations for some music is the Toucan between 10:30 p.m. and 2 a.m. Bands for this show have yet to be announced. This Tuesday, the RCHA will be hosting Tom's Tuesday Afternoon Happy Hour Jam starting at 4 p.m. Musiki will be hosting its free open mic from 8 to 11:30 p.m. And also, the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra will be performing Max Richter's reimagining of The Four Seasons at the Spire. Tickets are available on the Kingston Grand's website for between $45 and $20. Next up, on Wednesday, musician Ariel Posen will be playing at the Broom Factory from 7:30 to 10:30 p.m. Tickets are available online for $25 on Eventbrite. Also on Wednesday, Hotel Wolf Island will host its weekly open mic night starting at 8:30 with host Mike Rapkins. On Thursday, folks can head down to the Broom Factory at 7 p.m. to catch Cancer Bats, Teeth, and Mile End. Tickets for this concert are available for around $25 on Ticket Scene. Trailer Swift Band will be playing at the Buttle from 8 to 11 p.m. also on Thursday night. On Friday, Coletta and Super Yamba Band will be playing a concert at the Broom Factory from 7:30 to 10 p.m. Tickets are available for around $35 on Eventbrite. Also on Friday, the Toucan will be hosting a free acoustic evening with Johnny Kirawan running from 5 to 8 p.m. On Saturday, Devin Cole will be playing a show at the Broom Factory starting at 7 p.m. Tickets are available online for roughly $20 plus fees on Ticket Scene. The band Chelsea Road will be playing at the Buckle from 9 to 12:30. Also on Saturday, the band Cabbage will be returning to the Grad Club with their show starting at 8 p.m. Tickets are available online for between $15 and $20 on Eventbrite. On Sunday, folks can head down to the Buckle between 5 and 7 to catch their free open mic. Savannah Shea will be playing at Musiki between 4:30 and 6:30. And finally, Angelia Hewitt will be performing at the Isabel Bader Center at 2:30, with tickets available online for between $15 and $72 on the Isabel Bader's website. Have a concert you would like to add to our online and on-air concert calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at cfrcmusic on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. Once again, this is Henry, CFRC intern for the Department of History, continuing with this week's events calendar. On Monday, Loggers and Joggers Run Group meets at Fine Balance Brewing Company at 7 p.m. Also on Monday, both One Eye Jacks and The Brass will host their weekly trivia night starting at 7:45 and 8 p.m. respectively. On Tuesday, the Kingston Market is running at Springer Market Square from 8:30 to 4 p.m. The Lululemon Weekly Fun Run meets at 270 Princess Street starting at 5:30 p.m. Also on Tuesday, Euchre Night is happening at Daft Brewing from 7 to 9 p.m. After that, on Wednesday, One Eye Jats will be hosting Board Game Night starting at 7. Additionally, The Mansion will be hosting karaoke starting at 9. The Champions of Magic show will be coming to Kingston, where they'll be performing at Slush Puppy Place starting at 5 p.m. Tickets for this show will be available on their website, championsofmagictour.com, for between $48 and $119. Also on Wednesday, both Something in the Water and Daft Brewing will be hosting their trivia night starting at 7 p.m. Folks can also head down to Musiki, which is hosting its weekly life drawing event. Don't forget to bring your own art supplies and $5 and participate in uninstructed life drawing. On Thursday, the Kingston Public Market is open from 8:30 to 4 p.m. in Springer Market Square. Also on Thursday, the Out in Front Weekly Run Group has a public run starting downtown at 6:15 p.m. in front of Runner's Choice. All people are invited regardless of ability, sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity. Daft Brewing will be hosting its second annual post-COVID Kingston Young Professional Networking event on Thursday from 5 to 7 p.m. This event itself is free, although it is suggested that you reserve a spot through Eventbrite. Daft Brewing will also be hosting Queerioke starting at 8 p.m. There's a $5 cover charge at the door. On Friday, The Buckle and Daft Brewing will both be hosting their weekly free karaoke nights. Doors open at 9. Also on Friday, the Frontenats will be playing the Brantford Bulldogs at Slush Puppy Place, with their game starting at 7 p.m. Tickets are available online on Ticketmaster, at stores as listed on the Frontenats website, or at Slush Puppy Place itself. On Saturday, fourth-year students from Queen's University's MAPP, Media and Performance Production Program, will be performing a showcase of their culminating pieces at the Isabel Bader Center from 3 to 8 p.m. This is a free performance. Also on Saturday, the Kingston Public Market runs from 8:30 to 4 p.m. at Springer Market Square. On Sunday morning, the Runner's Choice Lawn Run starts downtown outside their store at 8:20 a.m. All ages and paces are welcome. And finally, the Memorial Center Farmers Market will take place from 9 to 1 p.m. at Memorial Center. Have an event you would like to add to our online and on-air event calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at cfrcmusic on Instagram using the link tree in our bio.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
Les Rendez-vous de la Francophonie is now on. Until March 31st, enjoy contests, performances, free film screenings, and local activities to cultivate your Francophone roots. Join in the fun and visit rvf.ca today.
When I say beat, you say banter. Beat. Banter. Beat.
Banter. When I say beat, you say banter. Beat.
Banter.
Beat.
Banter. Join us every Thursdays at 1 on CFRC for your special time with your favorite nuclear family.
My name is Aiden.
And this- This is Ella.
And you're listening to The Only Show.
Beat Banter.
On CFRC Radio.
Beat
Banter.
Who is this irresistible creature who has an insatiable love for the dead?
Tune in on Tuesdays at 3 p.m. for Dark Side of the Tune with me, your host, Tommy. The show where we look at the weird, the moody, the loud, and the unabashed. If the song falls on the dark side of music, then you can bet that we will play it. So join me Tuesdays at 3 p.m. See you there.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. This is edition 257. And on the broadcast today, I'm going to be sharing a conversation that I had with a community organizer in Montreal, Mustafa Hanawi. This conversation looks critically at the ways that there is a connection between contemporary policies around militarization and war and the years directly preceding 9/11. The connection is made here between the local and the global, looking at how migration policy is affected by war. I think this is a very important connection to make, and I'm really happy to share this conversation with community organizer Mustafa Hanawi, who works with the Immigrant Worker Center in Montreal. I think that, importantly, this conversation looks at the ways that we continually, in thinking about the importance of community organizing, can always seek out ways to connect the local and the global. So it's a pleasure to share Mustafa's perspectives and ideas here on Free City Radio, and I will let the conversation speak for itself. So here's my exchange with community organizer Mustafa Hanawi that was recorded on the streets in Montreal in Park Extension. So here it is.
We're in Park Extension right now in Montreal, and I'm sitting with Mustafa Hanawi, who is a community organizer at the Immigrant Worker Center and has been doing a lot of meaningful support work for different migrant communities, both around their working rights as workers, but also around supporting them in their struggle for status. So this is a huge moment right now for the Status for All movement. One element I was hoping maybe just to first talk to you about is understanding how speaking about status and like people's asks, demands for justice in terms of having their status is connected to things that are happening internationally. So just like sharing a bit with people around how, you know, what's reported, you know, in relation to war or displacement is part of understanding the picture of non-status workers, because that connection isn't usually made. So maybe you could first start by introducing yourself.
So my name is Mustafa Hanawi. I'm an organizer at the Immigrant Workers Center. I'm also a writer, and I've been active in migrant justice movements for over two decades now. And whether it be with taxi drivers in Toronto and the OCAP Immigration Committee, and then here at the Immigrant Worker Center.
OCAP is?
The Ontario Coalition Against Poverty.
So any thoughts about this sort of connection between the local and global? Because I also remember a lot of people were talking about that in the context of the years after 9/11, in the context of war, and war is definitely a reality right now also.
Well, I think then the connection was actually quite stronger, because a lot of, after 9/11, a lot of the immigration restrictions, increased border controls, the militarization of borders, and the communities affected were a direct result of the sort of the racist backlash, anti-Muslim, anti-Arab, racism and xenophobia that was inscribed in law in the days, months, and years after 9/11, right? That this was a very much a front in the war on terrorism, right? And what that meant was sort of the restriction on Muslim migrants, the sort of the The connections to what was the securitization of people's refugee claims, whether they were coming from Palestine or were Palestinian refugees, whether they were coming from Algeria, and or whether they were Pakistani men like Operation Threadbare, who were caught up in a web of RCMP and CSIS operations that led to their deportation on the grounds that they were that they were terrorists, right, or suspected of terrorism or accused of terrorism. So there was actually much more of a connection of what was taking place in sort of the unjust wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, but also this was the time of the Second Intifada in Palestine. And so there was always much more of a connection about the global issues and the local issues in terms of immigration. Now, unfortunately, we see less of that connection. And I think this is a problem because a lot of the debates we have around migration now, there's always this us and them, that we're being invaded by hordes of migrants, that these are simply economic migrants, that they are causing a crisis of our cost of living or causing a crisis around our housing, that our house is too full. Recently, the racism by Trump and the false narrative of Haitians eating animals in Springfield, Ohio. But there's never a discussion of how Haiti, as a failed state, was a project of the U.S. Through structural adjustment, coup d'etats backed by the U.S., that Haiti is no longer livable because of U.S. foreign policy. There's not that discussion when we're talking about why Haitians are moving here and what our responsibility is. There's no discussion around Palestinian refugees and our role in their displacement and continued displacement, because without a Palestinian state and without the right of return, Palestinians are forced to live in exile in the camps in Lebanon or in Jordan or in Syria,
refugee camps.
So the fact that there's no discussion about the role of Canadian and U.S. foreign policy, economic, politically, militarily, then you don't actually have an accurate description of why we're seeing waves of migration, who is coming, and why are people coming. So, for example, if you look at the largest, we now live in the moment where there are more refugees since World War II. And the vast bulk of those refugees are a direct result of Western political projects in the global south. So if we're talking about Afghanistan, Iraqi refugees, Palestinian refugees, which make up the bulk, South Sudan as well now, and also countries like in Venezuela, right? So in terms of the destabilization and the sanctions on Venezuela, regardless of what our perception is of Maduro and what that process is that the U.S. shouldn't be intervening there and shouldn't be sanctioning them. And as a result of that, now we're seeing some of the largest waves of refugees coming across the Darien Strait are Haitians and Venezuelans. So there's no discussion about the role we play in creating this mass destabilization. And our policy is no different than 9/11. Maybe the logic is the public discourse is quite different. Maybe the 9/11, or in the days after 9/11, in certain contexts. Now, I mean, in Germany, you have sort of the temporary ending again of the Schengen rules. So in terms of Germany just put up border controls all along its borders when that is not what it's allowed to do under the EU, under certain exceptions, but because of the far right. And also there had been an incident where a refugee claimant had, gone to the Israeli consulate in Munich. So, I mean, again, there's this context. We're not talking about German foreign policy, German military support for Israeli apartheid, in causing this mass destabilization across the region, whether it be Syria, whether it be Yemen, whether it be the economic policies in Egypt in terms of structural adjustment and propping up the Sisi regime. You know, Egyptians now make up the largest number of irregular migrants to Europe. And all of that is because we're supporting a military state through the IMF, through the World Bank, through Gulf capital to maintain its power while it impoverishes its own citizens to ensure that it is a gatekeeper for U.S. foreign policy alongside Israel in the region. So, but we don't have that discussion. We just have migrants from the global south who are invaders and who are taking our jobs and taking our resources and our public services. We don't have a real discussion. So, I mean, in terms of the links are there, but I, unfortunately, in the public discourse, we don't see it as it's completely missing, whether it be from the left or the right.
I recall there being very striking debates in the organizing spaces when people were organizing towards protests against the invasion of Iraq. And there was debates because some people wanted to have the voices of asylum seekers that were facing deportation to the regions impacted by war speak at the rally as part of our understanding of the effects of war. I'm just wondering if you have any reflections on that sort of discussion and how it's connected to this present moment.
Well, I mean, there'd always been that attempt. I mean, so if you even go back a bit further than the anti-war protests, sort of in the anti-globalization movement in 2000, 2001, even during 9/11, or like the protests, let's say at the World Economic Forum, or the G8 meetings in Alberta that took place, even though there was this, there was an attempt to push, say we have to talk about racism, we have to talk about xenophobia, we have to talk about war, but we have to talk about asylum seekers and refugees as part of an anti-racist and anti-war discourse. That this is a different front in the same struggle against war. And this is how we're going to concretely connect to those communities and actually mobilize with them and support them. Unfortunately, there was some section of the left that was too radical. We need to focus simply on anti-occupation, that it's disconnected from local politics. And I think that can have a very disturbing effect in terms of not just in the movement, but actually more broadly, right? And so, for example, when we wanted to talk about and it was very much connected to even Canada's role, right? When many people wanted to talk about not just ending the war, but ending the occupation, or talking about Canada's role in global imperialism. No, we just simply have to talk about the U.S. invasion. We have to talk about ending the invasion, anti-war. Anything else is too radical and will take away from the movement. But actually, by taking away those elements and those discussions, we actually took away from the movement, right? And the movement wasn't able to sustain itself after the war began, because we weren't having those discussions within the broader anti-war movement prior to the invasion. And so I think that's also an important lesson that could be learned, right? When if maybe we were talking about all of these things then, would our political landscape be different now? When thinking about the genocide in Gaza, thinking about what's taking place in the region, if we were talking and also the anti-migrant politics now, if we were connecting those things 20 years ago in a broad way, the political landscape could have been different now, as opposed to maybe what more radical elements within the movement were discussing that. And we see it now. We were right, right? Like, those parts of the movement were correct. right? Like, you can't talk about Iraq without talking about Palestine. You can't talk about it without talking about structural racism and global inequality. You can't. All of those things are deeply interconnected, and once we think we can just parcel things out of what would be the most popular, it's a shortcut in terms of giving the society our understanding of actually what's taking place and what needs to transform to not live in the kind of world we're unfortunately living in now.
So just to end, can you talk about now and like how those sort of critiques and those sort of important layers of analysis, but also organizing practice, relate to right now?
I mean, right now, you know, we live in a moment, I would say the last 6-7 years, where one, migrants have become a political scapegoat. Mm. In terms of propping up, U.S. imperialism, I mean, also propping up Canada's foreign policy, a sort of a chauvinistic, pro-war, anti-migrant discourse, right? And also we have a very weakened left. We can't. The responses have been mostly to pander to the right wing.
You mean within the institutional left?
Within the institutional left. Yes, we should be solidarity with migrants, but maybe there is too many migrants. There are issues as opposed to saying no, status for all. And if we build within these communities, we're actually going to rebuild the left. We'll rebuild a real base that actually has power and that's not just interested in local issues, but is fundamentally interested in the global context, right?
Yeah.
That is very much interested in ending the genocide in Gaza. That's very much interested in ending extractivist Canadian corporations that are gutting their countries for profit, such as the case of Guinea.
Like mining companies.
Mining companies.
Yeah.
We're talking about people who are struggling, not just for themselves or the communities here, but fundamentally would struggle for a better world. I mean, you see this in the Indian diaspora with migrants from the Punjab. Who are in solidarity with their brothers and sisters fighting against the corporatization of their food systems and agriculture, yet struggling for status here, struggling for workers' rights here. So all of those connections are there, and we should see that as this is, it's not the only part, but as a strong part of rebuilding a radical future, or the possibilities of a radical future. But yet, we unfortunately, I mean, I think in the institution left, there's still visions of what a mass movement would actually, a mass social movements would actually look like, and who would constitute them, and who has power in our society.
Just detail that a little bit.
So, I mean, I think we still look towards, some of the political parties like the NDP or the trade unions, or maybe, you know, the discussion of the middle class is constantly brought up as we have to win over the middle class. But why aren't we winning over people who live in Park X? Why aren't we winning? We're fighting for housing, who are fighting for status, who are fighting for labor rights, who are and fighting around international solidarity. That is, to me, where hope lies, right? And I think trying to constantly put this imaginary of a middle class, of a, you know, a white middle class, I think is a strategic. I mean, the orientation is. I mean, it's not a strategic failure. I mean, of course, you want to win over as many people in society, but at the same time, let's mobilize where people are willing to mobilize and are open to that discourse, and then we can win people over. Because even if you're a middle class worker, you're going to sympathize with people in Park X who are fighting for against their landlords or fighting against their scrupulous corporate employers. And then as a result, okay, maybe this is about status, and maybe I am going to learn about also what's taking place in India and what my government is doing in India, or what my the relationship to the ruling regime in India, or in terms of the genocide in Gaza and why people are here in limbo, in precarious work. So, I mean, all of that is connected.
Like Palestinians being
Palestinians. Yeah, so if we can work on those, find links between those concrete issues, but then talk about the global, I think it's really necessary. Because, I mean, in this moment, there's no way you can separate the two, and our enemies don't make any separation, right?
Yeah.
They have a much more, well, it's a simple and false narrative about the world in terms of the globalist elite who want open borders and who want their diversity and multiculturalism to erode, sort of you know, kind of a white nationalist narrative, and or sort of a protectionist agenda. I mean, they're talking about the bigger world, and they're connecting it to people's day-to-day realities, whether it be about inflation, whether it be about housing, whether it be, well, that's false and it's a complete lie, and it's using simping migrants and racism as a way to win over disaffected sections of the working class. We need to be doing the same.
Like talking about the global issues.
The global issues to the local and how they're connected. And we have to find that narrative again. We have to find that, not to repeat maybe what we were saying 20 years ago, but to really reflect on that moment and how we can create a new narrative in this moment that could actually speak to people, but not lose the essence of what we want to say, which is that all of these issues are connected from the global to the local.
I'm thinking, you know, you mentioned about people who are displaced from Palestine who are on the dealing with experiences of precarious work, right? And I know that the Immigrant Worker Center has over the years supported various Palestinian refugees who are, you know, working in warehouses or working as janitors. And it's so, like, meaningful to hear the way that you've connected all these issues. So thank you for discussing this today.
No, I mean, thank you. I mean, in terms of Palestinians directly, I mean, you have people, you know, it's very inspiring, you know, work with people who, from Ain El Helwe, who are, you know, who are fighting to return home, but also are fighting around health and safety rights.
Ain El
Helwe is a refugee camp in Lebanon. It's one of the largest camps in Lebanon. And also, and people who have been refugees for three generations or four generations. Palestinians also from Lebanon who are fighting for their co-workers inside Amazon. Palestinians who are also very integral in the protests. Palestinians from Jenin who are, you know, also again fighting for status, but also are fighting for the end of Israeli apartheid and occupation. So for them there's no separation, and for them it's about building a better world, whether it be here or back home.
Sure. Thank you.
That was a conversation with Mustafa Hanawi, who is a community organizer at the Immigrant Workers Center in Montreal. As you heard, this conversation looks critically at the ways that we can explore the connections between the local and global and look at policies of war and militarization abroad as directly connected to migration policy at home and the ways that immigrants and refugees often face criminalization due to the militarization of borders. Thank you so much to Mustafa for the conversation. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to the Social Justice Center at Concordia University in Montreal for your support. Free City Radio airs on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, 11:30 a.m. on Wednesdays on CJLO 1690 a.m. and also in Geauga-Gate, Montreal on Wednesdays at 8:30 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg at 8 a.m. on Tuesdays on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario at 11:30 a.m. on Wednesdays on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, BC on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. and Saturdays at 7:30 a.m. on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto at 5:30 a.m. on Fridays and on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. Also look us up as a podcast. Just search Free City Radio on your favorite podcast platform. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I will speak to you soon.